All right, let's talk about something truly fundamental, law. We usually think of it as, well, just the rules we live by, right?
Mm-hmm. The framework.
Yeah, the framework that structures our societies, codifies our norms, and, you know, kind of projects our vision of order. But what if it's more like the actual operating system of our civilization?
Okay.
And what if, despite all its incredible sophistication, its global reach, what if that system is actually hardwired to systematically undermine the very conditions for life to flourish on this planet?
Yeah, it's a heavy thought.
It is. And today we're taking a deep dive into this groundbreaking white paper. It's called From Incoherent Jurisprudence to Life-Coherent Law, Regrounding the Legal Order for Civilizational Renewal.
Quite a title.
It is. Yeah. And it makes this powerful and, frankly, pretty unsettling argument that our contemporary civilization is built on what it calls incoherent jurisprudence. Now, this isn't about like sloppy laws or bad writing. It's about a legal system that's procedurally brilliant, incredibly sophisticated, but fundamentally misaligned with life itself.
Right. The procedures work, but the outcome.
Exactly. So our mission today is to really unpack this powerful claim for you to understand how our legal systems got here, why this matters so much for the polycrisis we're all grappling with.
Climate breakdown, ecological collapse.
Pervasive inequality, all of it. And crucially, we'll explore what a life-coherent legal future could actually look like, because this paper suggests law can transform from just stabilizing contradictions into, maybe, an architecture for genuine renewal.
A big shift.
A huge shift. Okay, so before we dive too deep, let's clarify that core concept. What exactly does it mean for jurisprudence to be coherent, or maybe more worryingly, incoherent in this context?
Yeah, that's absolutely the right place to start, because coherence here isn't just about, you know, internal consistency in a law textbook.
Right.
It's defined much more broadly. It's really the alignment between the structure of law, its rules, its institutions, and the conditions required for life to flourish.
Okay, life itself.
Life itself. A legal system is coherent when it consistently protects and enhances universal life necessities, things we all need, like clean air, potable water, nutritious food, shelter, care, a sense of meaning, and really critically now, a stable climate.
Uh-huh.
And that needs to happen across all scales, from individual well-being right up to planetary health.
So incoherent is the opposite.
Exactly. Incoherent jurisprudence is when those legal doctrines, even if they're perfectly valid according to their own rules, systematically undermine those very necessities. Think of it this way. Imagine building this magnificent ship, perfectly engineered, every rivet in place, follows every naval regulation. It's procedurally brilliant.
Okay.
But the blueprint was drawn assuming the ocean is solid land.
Yeah.
The ship is perfectly legal by its own rules, but fundamentally misaligned with the reality of water. That's incoherent jurisprudence.
Wow, that's a powerful analogy.
It's a system that's procedurally amazing, incredibly sophisticated, but substantively, it's missing the point about life. And what's fascinating here is that it suggests mere legality, just following the rules, isn't enough anymore. We need life coherence for law to be truly legitimate, truly sustainable in the long run.
That ship built for land. Yeah, that really makes it click. It's a sobering thought.
Yeah.
And the paper then takes us on this fascinating historical journey, showing how this incoherence, it isn't new. It's been building for centuries.
Mm-hmm. Deep roots.
So if this problem is so deeply woven into law, how far back does the paper trace it? Does it go all the way to our earliest legal system?
Which it does, yeah. Right back to ancient foundations. Take Mesopotamian codes like Ur-Nammu or Hammurabi. They were revolutionary, right? Establishing written public law, bringing predictability.
Yeah.
Huge step forward.
Absolutely.
But here's the catch. They also explicitly entrenched hierarchy. Penalties varied massively by class, by gender. They basically normalized structural inequality right into the legal framework from the get-go.
So it's like the moment we started writing down rules, we were also coding in some of the biases we still see today.
Pretty much. It's baked in early.
What about the Greeks? We often idealize Athenian democracy, but their legal system, their nomos, wasn't entirely coherent by this definition either, was it?
Not at all. I mean, Greek nomos gave us incredible procedural innovations, jury trials, assemblies, fantastic stuff. But these coexisted with slavery, patriarchy, the exclusion of non-citizens.
Right.
So you had this rational, sophisticated law developing right alongside profound social and, frankly, ecological incoherence.
And then the Romans, they were famous for systematizing law.
They were. Roman jurisprudence achieved this unmatched systematicity, concepts like the Credis Gentium law of nations, trying to find universal principles beyond just Roman citizens, kind of the building blocks for international law.
Okay.
But it's crucial, while it was universal in form, it simultaneously justified conquest, slavery, domination. It clearly subordinated life and local communities to the needs of the empire.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So even back then, that pattern just keeps repeating.
It does.
And then as we move into the early modern period, you get social contract theories emerging, supposedly about liberty and individual rights. Did those help, or did they just deepen the incoherence in a new way?
Well, it's a bit of both, really.
Yeah.
Think of Locke's emphasis on property rights, hugely important. Advanced crucial constraints on arbitrary rule, important for individual liberty, no doubt.
Sure.
But they often conveniently excluded women, enslaved persons, colonized peoples, from their universal claims. So you see this deep incoherence between the rhetoric of universality and the actual scope of protection. It was a step forward for some life, but definitely not all.
This is where it gets particularly insightful for me, because the paper highlights how this history led directly to things like legal positivism in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Exactly.
So if I'm understanding this, it's almost like our legal system became so obsessed with how the rules were made, the procedure, that it developed this massive blind spot for what those rules were actually doing to the world, to life.
That's a great way to put it. The procedural brilliance, kind of, accidentally inoculated the law against moral or ecological accountability.
That's a really sobering thought. It wasn't necessarily malicious.
No, not necessarily. It often came from a genuine desire for certainty, for clarity, in a really complex world. Legal positivism, you know, figures like Bentham, Austin, Kelsen, they wanted to make law scientific, predictable.
Right. Separate it from messy morality.
Exactly. Sever law from morality. But the consequence was it allowed for formally valid laws, perfectly made according to the rules, to be profoundly unjust, oppressive, or even ecocidal, and still retain full legal force. In this framework, the paper notes the horrors of apartheid, segregation, even genocidal regimes could be seen as perfectly legal. The system could legitimize systemic harm, even if that wasn't the original intention.
And we can't talk about that era without mentioning the rise of corporate personhood and limited liability. They sound like these technical, maybe even useful tools for economic growth.
And they were, in a way.
But the paper argues they actually accelerated this incoherence. How so?
Absolutely. These innovations, they catalyzed incredible economic dynamism, no question, fueled industrial revolutions, global trade.
Right.
But they also did something else. They insulated capital from responsibility. They effectively allowed companies to externalize risks, social risks, environmental risks onto workers, communities, ecosystems.
So the profits stay private, the costs become public, or just ignored?
Pretty much. It's almost darkly ironic, isn't it? We invent this abstract legal entity, the corporation, for commerce.
Yeah.
And it ends up having more enforceable rights in some contexts than, say, a vital ecosystem or future generations.
It's like giving a calculator the right to vote, but not the planet it sits on.
That's not a bad analogy, actually, yeah.
That historical deep dive really lays the groundwork. It's unsettling to see how these foundational ideas evolved and maybe went off track. And it leads us directly to the core of the paper's argument, how these historical threads have woven themselves to five recurring patterns of incoherence in our modern legal system.
Right, the diagnosis.
Yeah, the diagnosis. What are these five core patterns that are essentially defining our current predicament?
Okay, these five patterns are really the bedrock of the problem, as the paper sees it. First, there's property primacy over life primacy.
Okay.
From those ancient codes all the way to modern corporate law, the system consistently prioritizes ownership, contract, corporate rights over fundamental life necessities, clean air, water, food, ecological stability. The paper puts it starkly. The instruments meant to serve life are elevated above life itself.
It feels like such a fundamental inversion, doesn't it? Property is supposed to enable life, not supersede it.
Exactly. It's got the priorities backward. Then second, we see sovereignty without stewardship.
Sovereignty without stewardship.
Yeah. The concept of state sovereignty, you know, solidified after the Peace of Westphalia way back when, has too often meant autonomy without accountability. States exploit resources, they externalize harms across borders or onto future generations with very little legal consequence.
So my country can do what it wants within its borders, even if it messes things up for everyone else.
That's often been the practical effect, yeah. It's a legal order that secures state authority, but often fails to safeguard the shared global systems, the climate, the oceans, that all states and all life actually depend on.
You know, when you talk about sovereignty without stewardship, it makes me wonder, isn't that just human nature, maybe?
Yeah.
To prioritize your own group, your local gain, over the bigger picture. Is the paper suggesting law can somehow change that impulse?
That's a vital point. And the paper doesn't deny self-interest or the huge challenges of global cooperation. But it argues that law isn't neutral here. Law shapes and codifies those impulses.
Wow. Okay.
If our legal structures actively reward short-term exploitation and insulate actors from the long-term harm they cause, then they're exacerbating that tendency. A life-coherent law would aim to reorient those incentives, structure accountability differently.
Got it. So it's about the rules of the game.
Exactly. Which leads us nicely to the third pattern, proceduralism over purpose.
Right. We touched on this.
Yeah. Modern law is brilliant at how things are done, due process, rules of evidence, jurisdictional rules, complex balancing tests. But it often loses sight of what ultimate purpose it's serving. A law can be perfectly valid and enforceable, yet ecologically catastrophic.
So it's like we became such good legal mechanics, we forgot to ask if the car was driving off a cliff.
Precisely. This formalist bias allows law to appear internally consistent, coherent in a narrow sense, while perpetuating profound substantive incoherence with life's needs.
Okay, that's three. What's the fourth?
The fourth pattern is the coloniality of law. This is about how European legal forms were exported through conquest, often violently subordinating indigenous legal traditions and their deep understanding of ecological reciprocity.
To systems designed for extraction.
Exactly. For imperial extraction. And the paper argues that even after formal decolonization, this logic persists. It continues in things like international debt structures, investment treaties, intellectual property regimes that often favor dominant economic powers and continue a legacy of extracting value from the global south or from marginalized communities.
So the patterns of power embedded in law didn't just disappear with independence.
No, they often just took new forms. And finally, the fifth pattern, commodification of meaning.
Commodification of meaning, what does that entail?
It means law increasingly reduces complex human and ecological values, things like dignity, community well-being, the intrinsic worth of nature into market terms. Think about law and economics approaches, or putting a price on carbon, or valuing ecosystem services.
But isn't valuing ecosystem services a good thing? Trying to make the economy see nature's value.
It can be, if it's done carefully, as one tool among many. But the danger the paper highlights is when this becomes the primary way law understands value, meaning dignity, sacredness, ecological integrity, things that can't easily be priced get flattened into mere commodities, or worse, they get erased from legal consideration altogether because they don't fit the spreadsheet.
They become externalities again.
Exactly. Life values that can't be captured by markets are systematically undervalued or ignored.
Wow. Okay, those five patterns, property primacy, sovereignty without stewardship, proceduralism over purpose, coloniality, and commodification of meaning, that's a powerful and frankly unsettling diagnosis.
It is.
And what strikes me is that they're not just separate flaws, they seem to feed each other, right? Like
yeah.
Prioritizing property enables sovereignty without stewardship, which then reinforces relying on procedure over purpose and so on. It feels like a kind of legal doom loop.
That's a good way to put it, a systemic feedback loop.
Yeah. Which is the real chilling insight here. So what does this all mean for us right now? These patterns aren't just theoretical concepts in a paper. They have tangible, sometimes devastating consequences for civilization itself. This isn't just about a broken legal system. It's about the foundations of our survival.
Indeed. And the paper connects these five patterns directly to four overarching civilizational consequences.
Oh.
Things we see playing out all around us. First, rights without responsibilities.
Okay.
Our jurisprudence has been very good at expanding rights, corporate personhood, transnational investor rights, individual liberties, all important in different ways. Yet the corresponding responsibilities, especially to ecosystems, to communities, to future generations, remain really weak or largely absent in enforceable terms.
So lots of power, not much accountability.
Exactly. This asymmetry produces systemic irresponsibility. It allows powerful actors to enjoy immunities while offloading harms onto others or onto the future. It's like giving someone all the privileges of adulthood, but none of the chores.
That's a perfect analogy. Okay, right. What's the second consequence?
Second, we face growth without ecological limits. Law, especially economic law, is structurally committed to endless economic growth, treating it as this unquestioned good.
The default setting.
It's the default setting. Environmental laws often end up acting as mere regulatory patches. They might slow down the damage here or there, but they don't fundamentally address the problem of systemic overshoot, of exceeding the planet's capacity.
And sometimes they even get in the way.
Sometimes they do. The paper points out that international trade laws, for instance, can actually actively constrain states from imposing necessary ecological limits if those limits are seen as barriers to trade. So you get this incoherence at a planetary scale, a legal system literally pushing us past the planet's breaking point.
That's deeply worrying. Okay, third consequence.
Third is justice as rhetoric without systemic design. We have constitutions, declarations, human rights treaties, all proclaiming equality, dignity, justice for all. Wonderful rhetoric. But in practice, the legal institutions themselves often reproduce deep-seated inequality. Marginalized communities face systemic barriers accessing justice, while, say, transnational corporations operate with vast legal resources and advantages. So the paper says, justice is proclaimed in rhetoric, but remains under-designed in practice. This erodes public trust and deepens social divisions.
Justice for some, maybe.
Effectively, yes. And fourth, perhaps the deepest consequence, is the creation of structural double binds.
Structural double binds. Explain that one.
This is where institutions get trapped in contradictions. Compliance with one legal imperative requires violating another, and life, human or ecological, gets caught in the crossfire.
Give me an example.
Okay, think of a local government, a city council. They might be legally mandated by state law to promote economic growth, attract investment, create jobs, but they also have a legal duty, maybe under environmental law or public trust doctrine, to protect the local watershed, ensure clean water. Then a big polluting factory wants to set up shop. It promises jobs and growth, fulfilling one mandate, but threatens the watershed, violating the other. The council is stuck in a double bind. Whatever they choose, they're potentially violating one of their legal duties.
And the community, the environment, often loses out.
Often, yes. Mm-hmm. Life pays the price for these built-in contradictions. Our systems are just full of these structural double binds where two valid legal mandates clash, creating paralysis or forcing damaging compromises.
That's a powerful diagnosis. It really drives home the point that law isn't just failing to prevent collapse. In many ways, it's actively complicit in creating the conditions for it. It feels almost overwhelming.
It can feel that way.
But the paper doesn't just leave us there in the diagnosis. It offers a path forward, a vision for what it calls life-coherent jurisprudence. And this next section, it really shifts the perspective, doesn't it, from despair to, well, maybe genuine possibility.
Absolutely. It moves from problem analysis to solution design.
So if our legal grammar is broken, how do we actually rewrite it? The paper proposes a few foundational first principles for regrounding law. These sound incredibly transformative. What are these new cornerstones?
They are indeed transformative. The first and really the most central principle is the life value axiom.
Life value axiom.
This is the core idea, basically. No law is legitimate if it systemically undermines the universal conditions of life. Simple but profound.
And those conditions are?
They're not abstract. They include the basics. Clean air, potable water, nutritious food, shelter, healthcare, education, meaningful participation in society, and, critically, a stable climate. Things essential for anyone, anywhere, to live a dignified life.
So property, contracts, sovereignty, they don't disappear.
No, not at all. The paper emphasizes they remain important instruments, but, and this is the key shift, only insofar as they serve and do not subvert life value. It's a fundamental reordering of priorities. Life comes first.
Okay, that makes sense. What's the second principle?
Second, there's holarchic responsibility. Now, holarchic, that's a bit of a mouthful.
Yeah, break that down for us. What's the practical difference between that and just saying everyone has duties?
Great question. Holarchic refers to nested systems, like hierarchies, but with interconnectedness. So, holarchic responsibility means legal duties must scale with power and impact.
Scale with power.
Yes. Individuals have duties, sure, but corporations have duties proportionate to their massive social and ecological impacts. States and transnational actors bear duties commensurate with their jurisdictional reach and their systemic capacity to either cause harm or confer benefit.
So the bigger you are, the more responsibility you have.
Essentially, yes. It's about ensuring that greater power comes with a stronger, legally enforceable duty to protect life values. It directly addresses that asymmetry of rights without responsibilities we talked about earlier.
That's clear. What's third?
Third is planetary boundaries as justiciable limits. Science has identified these critical ecological thresholds for the planet, right? For climate stability, biodiversity integrity, freshwater use, nitrogen cycles, and so on.
The safe operating space for humanity.
Exactly. So imagine the Earth has a kind of speed limit for carbon emissions or the pollution budget that we simply cannot exceed without crashing the whole system. This principle says that the law needs to treat those scientific limits not just as policy goals or suggestions, but as hard, enforceable legal boundaries.
Like a constitutional right for the planet to remain viable.
Precisely. Making them justiciable, meaning courts can actually rule on whether actions comply with these boundaries, maybe through constitutional provisions or specific statutes, it embeds ecological reality into the heart of law.
Okay, and the final principle.
And finally, intergenerational equity in guardianship. Law has historically been very biased toward present interests, present generations.
Short-term thinking.
Very short-term. This principle demands that we institutionalize the idea that present actors now hold resources and institutions in trust for future generations. We're custodians, not just owners.
How could that actually work in practice?
Well, the paper suggests examples like creating official guardianship bodies or ombudspersons for future generations within governments, or giving youth legal standing to bring cases to court arguing for their future rights. It's about extending law's protective scope proactively across time.
These principles sound truly transformative. I mean, almost like a reboot of our entire legal operating system. But
yeah.
Are there any real-world examples or even emerging ideas of how this regrounding could actually manifest in institutions or legal tools? It's one thing to have the theory.
Right. Is it just theory?
Yeah. Is it just theory or is it starting to happen?
That's where the paper gets very practical and I think quite hopeful. It points to several compelling examples already underway or gaining traction. For institutional redesign, consider Constitutions 2.0, embedding planetary coherence.
Constitutions 2.0.
Yeah. Think about Ecuador's 2008 constitution, which famously recognizes the rights of nature, Pachamama, as a constitutional principle. Nature itself has legal standing.
Right. I've heard of that.
Or look at New Zealand's Treaty of Waitangi co-governance arrangements, which embed indigenous stewardship concepts and give legal personhood to rivers and forests, ensuring they have representation in governance. These are concrete ways to enshrine life value at the highest level of law.
So it's not just about protecting nature from harm, but about nature having rights, almost like a legal person or being fundamentally part of the governance structure itself. That's a huge shift.
It's a paradigm shift. Yeah. Then there's ecocide as emerging hard law.
Ecocide, yeah. Mm-hmm. Making massive environmental destruction an international crime.
Exactly. There's growing momentum globally to recognize severe, widespread, or long-term harm to the environment as a fifth international crime at the International Criminal Court, alongside genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and aggression. The paper states that if enacted, ecocide could mark a paradigmatic shift, grounding international law much more firmly in planetary boundaries, not just state interests.
I would certainly raise the stakes for polluters.
Dramatically. Then, looking at specific legal tools, the paper mentions algorithmic due process.
Okay, AI and the law.
Right. As AI and algorithms increasingly govern aspects of our lives, from loan applications to predictive policing to resource management, law needs to catch up. We need to ensure things like explainability, auditability, and accountability for these machine-driven decisions.
To make sure AI doesn't just amplify existing biases or create new forms of incoherence.
Precisely. It's about ensuring our evolving technology remains aligned with human and ecological well-being, keeping life value at the center.
Makes sense. Any other tools?
And a really crucial one, potentially, is the idea of substantive coherence tests.
Substantive coherence tests.
Yeah, imagine this as a new tool for judges, or maybe administrative bodies. It would essentially require them to ask, does this specific law, this policy, this proposed action, fundamentally protect or undermine the universal conditions of life?
So, moving beyond just checking if the procedures were followed?
Exactly. If the assessment shows it systemically undermines those core life conditions, then, the paper suggests, it fails coherence review, regardless of its procedural validity or claimed economic benefits. It shifts the legal focus from just how a law was made to what effect it actually has on life. It forces the system to confront its real-world impact.
That could be revolutionary. What's fascinating here is that these aren't just pie-in-the-sky ideas anymore. They're happening rights of nature, ecocide law debates, new constitutional arrangements, or they're being actively debated and developed right now.
Mm-hmm. There's real movement.
It suggests that the legal community and society more broadly is in some ways already grappling with this necessary shift toward a more life-coherent future, even if it feels like a monumental uphill task.
The conversation has started.
Definitely. So let's recap. Today, we've explored this profound argument that our legal systems, while often procedurally brilliant, are fundamentally incoherent with the needs of life itself. We traced its deep historical roots.
Back to Mesopotamia.
Right. We diagnosed its five core patterns in modern law: property primacy, sovereignty without stewardship, proceduralism over purpose, coloniality, and the commodification of meaning. And we saw the devastating civilizational consequences that flow from that, from rights without responsibilities to those paralyzing structural double binds.
A pretty stark picture.
A very stark picture. But crucially, most importantly, we also looked at the exciting and necessary path forward towards a life-coherent jurisprudence, one grounded in new first principles like the life value axiom, holarchic responsibility, planetary boundaries as actual legal limits, and intergenerational equity.
And we saw some concrete examples of how that might look.
Exactly. Which brings us to the big question, really.
Yeah, this raises a really important question for all of us, you know, not just lawyers or academics. If law truly is the operating grammar of civilization, as the paper puts it, and if that grammar is currently leading us towards systemic breakdown, then the task isn't just to tweak the grammar rules. It's to fundamentally reclaim the purpose of the language itself.
Reclaim the purpose.
Yeah. The paper issues this really clear call, almost a challenge. It says, jurists once declared that slavery was incompatible with human dignity, that segregation was incompatible with equality, that apartheid was incompatible with justice. Today, the equivalent challenge is to declare that a jurisprudence blind to the conditions of life is no jurisprudence at all.
Wow, that puts it in perspective. So what does this all mean for you listening right now? It's a powerful thought, isn't it?
Mm.
What if the most profound act of justice in our time isn't just about human rights in isolation, but about ensuring that our legal systems uphold not just social order, but the living order, the ecological foundation on which everything else depends?
A fundamental shift in thinking.
It really is. What kind of legal system do you want to live under?
Mm-hmm.
And what role can you play, maybe in your community, in your work, or just as a citizen, in demanding and helping to build a more life-coherent future? What would it actually mean for your rights and your responsibilities if life value was truly the first principle of law? It's definitely a conversation that can't wait.